This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. Access a vast selection of global fixed income securities at Interactive Brokers Bond Marketplace. Search their deep availability of over 1 million bonds globally and use IBKR's bond search tool to compare available yields against those of other brokers. Interactive Brokers has no markups or built-in spreads and low, fully transparent commissions on their bonds. IBKR displays the highest bid and lowest offers received from the electronic venues they access. In addition, clients can interact with each other by placing bids and offers online to execute their trades. Learn why Benzinga rated Interactive Brokers their best online broker for bonds for two consecutive years. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Visit ibkr.com/bonds.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Two more hot inflation reports. Stickier than we thought, huh? What goes up doesn't actually have to come down, but often checks back. Tax season is here. A few friendly reminders. And our guest is Paul Barron from the Paul Barron Network. All this and much more on episode number 860 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And here we are again, and it's getting to be actually fun again. I mean, the markets actually have some volatility. It's back. Well, that's not, we don't have a lot of volatility, but at least there's some volatility. You're seeing some movement on both sides, up and down. And not only with markets, we're talking about with a lot of the securities that had a one-directional move. We talked about that last week, up, up, up. And that's great. Love owning them. But you know what? Sometimes, as I mentioned, what goes up doesn't have to necessarily come down, but it could check back a little bit or stall. And that is what we're seeing right now in some areas. Valuations are probably being looked at as stretched. And the concern over some of the inflation numbers we saw, I mean, we saw some. We'll talk about that in a second, right? Just a quick, for the first timers out there, hey, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I am the host of this show. I'm the co-host of DH Unplugged. I've actually run as a host of many other podcasts over the years. One of the first doing it since 2007 or so. And also the author of two books. One of them, the first, that is the name of this podcast, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. Available, by the way, on audiobooks if you want. And we work with people like you. That's what we do on a daily basis. We are working with people that have investments and want to basically find a way that they can optimize as best as possible for their future. We make it really easy. We make it, that's I think the most important part of this whole process. It's easy. So the things we talk about on these shows are things we're actually putting into action and into planning processes each and every day with our clients. It's not some ethereal discussion, some academic wonder. It's reality. And we have to, it's not just, oh, he said that and then changed his mind. Well, you know what? The fact is there's real money on the line when it comes to the things we're talking about. Keep that in mind. By the way, I'm having a birthday this week. Yep. This is, all right, don't tell anybody, but this is the last one in my 50s. I remember very distinctly, I was sitting there in my backyard, and I remember when I turned 50 that I said, I could never say that I'm 40 again. And I was thinking at that time also, wow, you know, 50, what is that? Well, it's kind of like half of 100. That means that half of my life is almost over. And now here I am, the last number, I'm not going to say it, I can't deal with it. The last year of my 50s, I'm thinking, wow, you know, if that If I'm a 60-40 portfolio here, I'm starting to turn the other side. You know, I mean, it's funny because I feel the same as I've always felt. I mean, yes, all right, I'll admit it, a little bit sore, stiffer than I was. But I was thinking that, you know, I don't know. I mean, thinking about 10 years ago or so, can I do all the things that I did? Maybe not as well, but some things I'm doing better. And when I think about where I am as I get older, I also think about what does it look like in 10, 20, 30 years from now. One of the things we know as we get older, we look back and realize how stupid we were, the things we could have done, the things that you could do right now, by the way, to make sure that you are set for the future. And I think about, okay, you know, let's take a look at that spreadsheet. Where are we? And, you know, how are things looking? Like you do all the time as well. And it's something that you need to make sure that you keep on top of, setting yourself up for the future. And that's what we try to do here each and every week. We try every episode to bring you some new information or information that will give you the experience that you need and really supercharge your financial education so that you can use it to make sure that you are, in other words, use the wisdom that I have over the last 30, 40 years. I don't want to say 40, 30 years. Well, it is 40 years almost. Let's see, it would be 40 would be, yep, that's about right. About 40 years in this business. Ugh. 40 years in this business, just about. And I can give you all and impart to you what I know and what I have learned so that you can use it and run with it. All right, so let's talk about those ever-increasing stock prices. No, 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 no. Here's something that you need to know. Absolutely not. The cycle is not broken. It isn't done, and it is still intact. In fact, quite intact. And cycles from peak to trough sometimes are higher, sometimes lower, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, sometimes more intense. Sometimes they get in trouble. Sometimes you don't even notice. But they are intact. This week, we saw that inflation came in, and it's not just going from top to bottom, bottom to top. They were seeing that right now, the numbers were hot for both CPI and really hot, 0.6 month over month for PPI, the producer price index, which is wholesale inflation. And that is telling us something, and something that, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it's a surprise to me at all, that this idea that disinflation going to zero inflation, you know, is nonsense. The fact is that one of the things we did, and I think we did very badly, was that the idea that disinflation was here and that we beat inflation and that everything is going to go back to normal probably is helping to revive some of the inflationary pressures that we're seeing. Markets, they're trying to slough it off. But again, there's nothing showing me that inflation is necessarily done with us unless we decide to accept somehow, miraculously, that, well, you know, a 3% inflation rate is fine. Don't worry about it. So I do think that some of the things that have happened recently and the thought of a 7 rate cut and nobody saying you're nuts and the Fed not really coming out and saying, no, that's probably not going to happen, has really created another round of potential inflation. Maybe it's not the same inflationary pressures we saw on the way up, but it may actually make the current level is much more stickier. So something to think about. And markets are going to react accordingly, by the way. Quickly, before we get to our guest, I want to mention it's tax season. We're here right in the middle of it, right? We're the third week of March. And you have to remember, you need to max out your retirement plans. You need to make sure that you're fully funded in your IRAs. You need to be organized, organized, organized. Every day of the year leading up until right now, you should be doing something to make sure that you're organized. For example, every receipt that I get is scanned and put into a folder, 2023, 2024 receipts. This way, if there's ever an audit, if there's ever a problem, you got it all. And it's easy for a handoff to your CPA. Or if you're doing it yourself, it's really easy to plug all that information in. So keep yourself organized. You can get the most deductions available and make sure that you're set in the event that you have to prove something in the future. And you still have about a month or so to file the 1040s, but no reason to wait for the last minute. So with that, let's answer that phone. Let's get on with a discussion, because I think we're going to really delve into, I have a load of questions here, delve into crypto pretty hard here. And our guest today is Paul Barron. He hasn't been on for some time, but he's a technologist, a futurist. He's been involved with major market shifts and known things the last 25, 30 years. He's been involved in the restaurant and retail business. He has some amazing podcasts. He has a channel, a network, all sorts of stuff that he's done. He's been a filmmaker, a speaker. He's also been very involved in consumer behavior. Lots to get to, but one of the things we're really going to focus on today is something that we don't talk about very often, which is also the area of cryptocurrencies and DeFi. And I know Paul really well. He's going to throw out a lot of phrases. I'm going to probably stop him on and do a little educational and breakdown for the audience, because some things I have no idea what he's talking about sometimes either, but I just shake my head and say, yeah, it sounds good. Paul, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. It's great intro there, Andrew. I love it.
Thanks. And you know, one of the things that's interesting is I remember, you know, we did a on your network, we did a podcast recently. Mm-hmm. And yep. Somehow the word boomer came up a few times as I was talking in the background, which pissed me off to no end, by the way.
You can't take our producers with what they are doing. What they're talking about is investment. I think in that particular episode, it was investment styles. Mm-hmm. You know, that there are certain classes of investors that look at the investment landscape differently. And whether you're a boomer, a Gen X, or a millennial, you could fall into that classification of a boomer investor.
I don't truly qualify from an age standpoint.
It's not even a demographic thing. It's a term that is used in the culture of crypto Twitter, which many people will recognize HODL, you know, WEN, which is WEN. That's basically, you know, when is the project going to moon, or when is it going to go up? There's a lot of vernacular. You almost need a dictionary.
It's very easy to know. It's when things are spelled wrong.
Or if
they exclude vowels,
or if they're the acronyms, you know, right. Which is you know, notorious from Silicon Valley, which is obviously some of my background. So I'm very used to that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just kept when they put that up there, I kept on thinking like old dumbass. That's what I was thinking was being said to me.
Not at all. I think it's actually a respectable term.
Yeah. All right.
Because when people look at boomer demographic versus boomer investor. Boomer investor is, these are basically the whales of crypto. These are the people who've been around a long time. They've seen a lot of different opportunities, both in traditional finance as well as in, you know, DeFi and Bitcoin and Ethereum and all the, you know, the different tokens that are available out there. So
you should be proud of it.
You should be proud of it. At my point.
I'll wear a patch on my sleeve, okay?
It's like OG.
That's good. That's good.
Many people, I look at that and say, wait a minute, I'm not the old guy.
Old guy, they think, right?
That's been here. You're the guy that knows how to do this.
Yeah. Well, let's go backwards. First of all, the last time you were on was back in September. I think it was September 2020, which I didn't realize it was that long, to be honest with you. I'm hoping it was not. I'm incorrect about that. And the VIX was up to like 40 at that point, and things were going haywire. And you know, we were wondering when this thing is going to end. Are we going to, you know, all just be swallowed up by this whooping cough or whatever it was going on? Right. Things have changed a lot. Obviously, there's been a market revival. You know, obviously, not to mention that. The what was happening then was we were seeing soaring of Bitcoin and the idea of things that were to come. But I want to wind that back, and then I want to start talking about a couple of things, about what I call the three pillars in my world of crypto, and get your comments on that. But I want to start with, who is Paul Barron? And I want to get my audience set straight in terms of your days back with Microsoft and your history and what you've done and kind of where you are now. So can you give us a little bit of a briefing?
Yeah, I mean, I came out of college. I was basically a computer science major and worked in software, and started with Microsoft in, you know, the late 90s, worked with them under Ballmer. Well, his tenure was there. He didn't become CEO, I think, till 2020, but, you know, and had a chance to really kind of learn the ropes of what was happening in software. I won't necessarily say Silicon Valley, but it was the Silicon Valley, you know, model. you know, that was happening. And it was really the dot-bomb era. So I got a chance to have a front row seat in an era in which there was a ridiculous amount of froth in the market, as you well know, in terms of even the stock market, which was looking at all these companies coming out of Silicon Valley as, you know, kind of the darlings in the next generation, much like what we're seeing in AI right now, by the way.
Right.
And so I did that. And then my job was to work with retail to basically put Microsoft OS into retail systems. This was prior to the days of touchscreen, all of those, or even obviously the iPad. So that was my gig. I did that and fell in love with the restaurant industry from a technology side. And basically I was like their Steve Jobs of the restaurant industry. My job was to help a lot of these big brands make a move into converting from what was a very stale process of how to run their business to a much more technological, you know, model. So I worked with all the major brands, developing everything from front of house, drive-through technology, you know, you name it, we were involved in it. We helped create the double lane at at McDonald's. We worked on a lot of the advancements with Sonic Drive-In, Starbucks, Taco Bell, Panera, you know, all the big brands now. Even when I was doing that, I kind of fell in love with it and noticed that there was this big missing hole in the industry, which was really digital publishing, because everything was a magazine at that time. So I launched a few websites. They got really big and we became pretty much the first real player in the digital version of B2B publishing. And then I merged that into another company. We launched a handful of podcasts in the birth era of podcasts. There was only a handful that were out there, you know, after Adam and Weiner kind of got this thing going. You had Laporte from Twit, who was kind of, he was kind of the tech titan in podcasting. And then we spun up our podcast for the restaurant industry. And it was the first one. I think it was 2007.
Yeah, that's when we started.
Yeah, okay, well, see.
There, and by the way, I am the OG of financial podcasts.
There you go, that's my point.
That's the point.
And that is a term of love. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, got into podcasting, really saw the vision of where that was going. I wrote a couple of books. One was called The Chipotle Effect, which was really not about Chipotle, but it was the effect that brand was having on, at that time, Gen X and millennials, and the adoption of social media and mobile and how that would change, you know, the future of the restaurant industry. That was a decade ago.
The Chipotle Effect is not the after lunch requirement to either go to the bathroom or sleep.
No, it's a consumer science book.
Ah, gotcha.
So it talks a lot about the reasonings of why, you know, consumers behave the way they do. And, you know, mainly we started building a technology at that time. This was around 2012 to start tracking consumer behavior. And I shouldn't say tracking. That's a bad word. Analyzing.
Yeah. Tracking sounds like you're...
Yeah, we're not tracking anybody. Yeah, it's we're analyzing. We're just looking at how people behave online.
Right.
And we created an algorithm that gave us a rough sentiment score, which eventually started to do really well in the space. We started to migrate it into other data models. And we've been growing that, you know, since. And then around 2019, we spun out our network. And I'm kind of going with a shortcut here, but in 2019, we spun out our network to where we had a food division and we had a tech division. Mm-hmm. And we all know what happened in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And COVID pretty much broke our business when it was a food business.
Right.
In terms of publishing, it pretty much killed it. 80% of our advertisers were gone in really a quarter. Mm-hmm. And it took us a decade to build that business. But that was my second venture. And we thought, well, we can either throw in the towel or we can put everything in on tech. And I just, you know, rejoined what really I had been doing all along, which was evangelizing technology in business to business. And we started and we worked in the AI space. the robotic area, electric vehicles, and blockchain. And then around early 2021, you know, we had our bull run, and blockchain consumed our content and eventually became our focus, which is what we're doing today.
It's interesting because the blockchain slash crypto slash DeFi, whatever you want to package that genre into, right? The advertiser, they came real fast, real hard with lots of money and then disappeared just as fast. Did they though?
Yeah. I mean, what you're dealing with, this is a really good topic to talk about today because what you have been dealing with in the past, the first time I looked at blockchain was in 2016. And we looked at it really hard, mainly for authenticity, provenance, sourcing certification in the food industry. And it wasn't ready because there was only a handful of very rudimentary blockchains out there and Bitcoin. That was it. Ethereum had not even been launched. That was in 2017. So a lot of what we know today is such new technology that the cycle was very predictable. And that's what they call them, these cycles, these four-year cycles of crypto. Very predictable. But that all changed this year when BlackRock launched their ETF and pretty much, you know, brought the degenerate to Wall Street.
Well, you know, it's interesting because let's talk about that for a second. Well, I just want to go back to one thing. So I don't know about you, and I think we may have talked about this, and I probably did bring this up on one of your shows that you had me on, but one of my very intriguing stocks that I liked that was going through some growing pains was a company called Toast. Did I bring that? I think I brought that up with you. And that thing is really just finally gotten out of its way, finally looking at profitability, finally looking at a good run rate, some of the things that they tried earlier on with the to-go fees and things like that that they had to reduce down. And that kind of, you know, it was a company that was trying different ways to monetize various parts of the business. But one of the things that I really liked about it, and Toast is not unique to this, right, is that they were able to join, we'll call it consumer or customer to front end to back end to management, right? That package, right? From the eating to the ordering to the understanding about your servers to your efficiency of putting food out, what needs to be, you know, you have the whole thing going on there.
Toast
plus
is,
points of service.
Yeah, Toast is a very interesting business. The only reason that they got slammed, you have to remember when they went public and the potential, I mean, they opened really high. I think that what was it, around 60 or 70 bucks? I mean, it was way up there for a brand like that, I thought. And then they kind of normalized, you know, from just a stock mainly. And I know the guys at Toast real well. They used to be one of our advertisers on the food side of our business. And so we knew all of their angles. We also know their competitive landscape. But what happened, you know, really over the last couple of years, I guess probably maybe 22 to where we are now. And I'm just looking here at the chart right now. If you look at the and just draw a line of their trend line, you know, from their bottom, which was around 13 bucks to where they are now, which is around 25. Right. This is a pretty good trend line up.
Right.
But that's a very unique time between 22 and where we are now. And there's two reasons. One is that at that time, almost all the tech companies that were in food service had already been obliterated by COVID. They just didn't have the talent. And then the new guys had not got their footing just yet. So now you have a lot, and then you got to remember, VCs were pouring in money into the food service industry for tech because of all these restaurants having to convert to digital sales. So Toast was at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
That's why they won.
Yeah, and again, I think also because what you can do with that from a restaurant standpoint, while it is an expensive proposition to get into this, right? Simple TOST, by the way. It's an expense, and we own that for clients. And I own that personally. Why is it expensive? It's an expensive proposition. It is one of those things that's like, wow, what is the actual ROI on this, right? From a standpoint of not only, okay, if I just put it in, I'm going to make money on it because of some reason. No, I'm talking about the efficiency savings, you know, is tremendous. Yeah. The mistake issues that is like, oh, No, I didn't see that ticket that was up in the carousel. You follow what I'm saying? The yes. The issue of when to fire, we'll use some language from the restaurant industry, when to fire the appetizer, when to send the drinks. You follow what I'm saying? That could all be yep. done with a handheld at the or on a terminal from the server standpoint, right? There's just a lot, or for that matter, management can be looking at stuff and saying, hey, you know what? That table needs to go. Fire that appetizer over there. They ate their stuff really fast. You know what? Get the salads out. And yeah. from an expediter who's only – expediter's only sitting, staring at the chefs on a warming tray, right? You've mm-hmm. got my vision here?
Yep.
To now having kind of like, well, that expediter or a expediter assistant, if you will, allowing runners to take food. It just creates a much different experience for that restaurant that – wants to have a higher level of efficiency, you know, involved in it. So not fast food necessarily, although it does work for that. Just somewhere, you know, fast casual or casual, that whole area, right? Would you agree?
Yeah. I look at these technologies, though, as short-lived.
What do you think is going to take over?
I think AI is going to take over.
Well, but
you know,
but it still
has automation.
Well, you're not going to have an What's AI that? Walking in a restaurant going, "What would you like to order?" Hi, my name is Amy the AI. I'm going to be your food server.
No, not at all. The situation right now. This has been repeated time and time again. This is where I built my entire career, was in integration of retail systems.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were building this in the early mid-90s, early 2000s, we were replacing the ECR, okay? Mm-hmm. That's the electronic cash register. You probably don't know what they look like, but mm-hmm. it's a non-POS terminal.
Right. I remember the ones with the handle that you had to pull down and the tape came out of the top.
No, that's just a cash register. That's not even an ECR.
Yeah, I remember those.
So an ECR, they were not touchscreen. They were membrane keyboard. They would have a very small amount of local RAM. I don't want to get into history.
Was that
on
from
this,
NCR? Did NCR make those?
Yes. Yeah. NCR. Yeah. Yeah. There was a handful of companies that were pretty much the titans of that. They are now, of course, were replaced with almost all point of sale systems, everything from Aloha to Squirrel to Micros. What you know today, you know, when you look at even what Oracle is doing with their acquisitions in the food service retail space. But my point being, is that cycle lasted about 20 years. And the problem is that with companies like Toast, when I look at this, I say, okay, well, they've already spent the last 8-9 years, maybe 7 years, building all of this technology based on the iPad generation, which is okay. No mm-hmm. problem there. Mm-hmm. That's reasonable. But unless they are ready to skate where the puck is going in terms of AI automation. And what I'm talking about is the large language models that each brand of business has access to,
mm-hmm.
To be able to build a much smarter point of sale and back office terminal. That's where I think a lot of these companies like a Toast might miss it if they don't really cut. Olo is another one. Olo is another public.
You got to think that they're going to have some kind of,
they have to be able to move to this.
Computer generated, or you want to call it AI just for an all-encompassing, that's fine. You know, some kind of computer-aided efficiency technology, whatever that is exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you could call, many people will argue, well, it's not really AI, it's, you know, it's machine learning, it's, you know, things of that nature. I get it, but as AI is a language model. It's that simple. If you plug in data, you get a result. It's not that it's learning upon itself unless the data model is learning on itself.
Yeah, let me throw this out to you. Ready? Here you go. You got a point of sale, a little device that you have with you. This yep. person says, you know, you have a food server that you train, mm-hmm. but you know, whatever, right? The food server, whatever. And you talk about them in the restaurant industry doing right. Upsells, right? Well, whatever. And you maybe even give them bonuses on their upsells, right? Or something, but they're just busy right. doing their stuff, whatever. Well, wouldn't it be nice if the person orders a burrito supreme with whatever, that up all of a sudden pops up, says, hey, you know what? How about you get this, you know what goes really well with that? Spicy jalapeno margarita or something. You know what I'm saying? That there's some thinking that's going on with the machines, with the systems that yeah. can aid and assist the servers or whoever.
And probably not as much on the front line. I mean, there will be technology that the front line will have that will help assist that. This is more about increasing frequency and increasing throughput to get the customer there. Because the problem in that industry, even still to this date, is the competition is just getting so brisk. So it's difficult for a restaurant to win. And the only way they win is if they have a significantly more advanced system in able to acquire customers. And this is known well in the e-commerce and the SaaS industry. I think that the software, and I should say,
Why don't you take one second to reel that in? SaaS?
Yeah. So
it's not SaaS-y, just to let you know, people, it's something different.
SaaS, software as a service. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Software as a service. So I think, you know, we're kind of going down a rabbit hole here, but I think that part of the business, restaurant as a service, so to speak, in the future, will be how it integrates with other systems where consumers are. And this is where consumer science gets into it. This is where blockchain comes in.
But this makes an assumption. This also makes an assumption that we've commoditized the palate. And I want to tell you a story. I was so excited. I've talked to you about this. Well, just hang on. Let's just one thing I'm saying.
All right.
Not entirely, by the way, of course, right? You know, there's different levels of, you know, you're not going to replace the master chef, right, at a fine restaurant with any kind of AI. You may help with some of the, you know, but just
not now.
Well, okay. Well, you know what? There's the Star Trek replicator. We're going there. Are we going that far?
No.
Okay. But here's my point. You know, I was hopped up. I was excited. I forgot the name. The restaurants they opened up. Ghost kitchens. I was thinking, this is a great idea. This ghost kitchens. And, you know, you have all these possibilities where I'm going to have maybe, I don't know, they're going to open up, they're going to get this big kitchen. They're going to open up like a Chicago deep dish. I'd be able to deliver to me because it's now over there and it's all delivery and it takes a whole area, you know, and all this great stuff. You know, the whole ramp up of ghost kitchens. I'm just telling you what I saw down here. Miserable failure. The food sucked.
Those were miserable failures.
Food
but they were,
sucked.
I don't know that ghost kitchens were designed to solve a future problem. They were designed to survive. That was it.
Yeah, I thought it was a good idea, but the execution was all about money. Let's be honest. It wasn't about the flavor.
Well, what happened was you had these companies like Reef and all these guys that jumped into that that tried to make a bunch of money on it. I get it. Yeah. Okay.
Terrible. Anyway, continue. I'm sorry. You were talking.
But I'm just saying that, that business model does not work in a hospitality driven field. So restaurants that understand how to acquire guests, this is the age old problem. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's just that there's going to be new tools that will enable that to happen. And right now, the problem with that industry is you have to bolt on tools into different programs like a Toast product or many others. And this has been a situation that has happened over the last 20 years. You know, a point of sale doesn't interface with this. You got to bolt this back office in, this front of house on, this, you know, kitchen service product on. Same thing's happening with Toast now. Olo is the same situation. They, of course, are the gateway to e-commerce for pretty much the entire industry right now. Mm. But I think there's a handful of startups that will disrupt this again, just like Toast disrupted NCR and Aloha and Squirrel and Micros and all the other companies.
Cool.
I think it'll face the same situation.
Let's shift gears here. I want to talk about the area that you really love and you enjoy talking about, and you have a lot of shows dedicated to on the Paul Barron Network. You can find that. By the way, where can people find that? The best place to
YouTube.
One click.
Yeah, YouTube, Paul Barron Network.
Yeah, there you go. I want to talk about crypto and all that, but just we have to take a moment because we have to talk about Interactive Brokers. So just when we get back, we are going to go head deep into the discussion of crypto, DeFi, and all the good stuff that you love so much. But let's talk about Interactive Brokers and discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop, Interactive Brokers' next generation trading platform. It's built from the ground up, and IBKR Desktop combines their powerful features with a unique set of groundbreaking tools in a streamlined, intuitive interface. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, IBKR Desktop redefines what you can expect from a trading platform. Experience the future of trading today. Visit IBKR.com/desktop to learn more and download IBKR Desktop today. All right, back with Paul Barron talking about, we're going to talk about crypto. We're going to talk about areas that you may never have heard of, but I want to just talk about something. Because I got a little bit of, you know, me, I think, well, let's just go here. Let's not set the stage. Let me just tell you my thoughts. First of all, I've always thought that the idea of cryptocurrency, I'm not talking about the technology for a minute, I'm talking about cryptocurrency for a second. You know, when people bought it, there was three-legged stool possibilities why different people wanted to buy it, or maybe they like two of the three or all three of the three. Number one, store of value. Oh my God, the government is going to burn down the house. The dollar is going away. You're going to have inflation out of control. You have to have something that's alternative to gold, stable store of value, even though it has volatility. That's the play. That's number one. Number two, that may not be exactly how you see it. That's how I see it, I'm telling you, okay? Number two, it's a great opportunity for transaction-based. I can do this wherever. You got a lot of these guys some of these yappers I call them, you know, the Bitcoin bros. They're like, oh, yeah, I could do a transaction on a weekend. Can you do that with your bank? I'm like, yeah. I go to the ATM. I can take out money. I can send money. I don't understand. I can do it with PayPal. I can do it with Zelle. I don't understand. But anyway, you know, you can do transactions. And by the way, the hair doesn't rise in the back of my neck when I send money to somebody that I'm worried that I can't get it back no matter what I do if I sent it to the wrong, you know, hash. And number three, the idea that it's a speculative investment or an investment of sorts. That's the three areas that I saw.
So wait a minute. What was number two?
Currency to spend, transactions.
Okay. And then number one was
store of value.
Replacement of the dollar. Okay.
Replacement of dollar, gold, some kind of store of value. You know, it's a safety valve for holding. That's gotcha. The way I saw it. You know, three possible. Now, I'm not talking about all the technology can be bolted on. I'm talking about the general ways that originally people like, you know, now even Michael Saylor doesn't even talk about anything anymore that I heard in the last conversation, except for the fact it's an investment. And the thing he talked about was, what did he say this last week? It was something, let me think. Volatility is a feature, not a bug. Involved. That's what he said. Volatility.
So you're talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah, Bitcoin. Yeah. Volatility, yeah. Clearly Bitcoin. Volatility is a feature, not a bug. I'm like, oh, okay. So it's an investment. And what is he doing? Well, he's leveraging the house said this. That's what he said. He said he's a MicroStrategy leverage. Now, I go way back with him, back to 2000s, where he screwed me over with his bad accounting.
So you got a grudge to bear here?
Yes, I do.
What's up?
Yes, I do. Yeah, it cost me a lot of money. Me and my clients. Yep. A lot. Now, the only good news is it was probably the best class action I've ever seen.
MicroStrategies, right?
MicroStrategy. I'm talking about MicroStrategy. I'm talking about Michael Saylor at MicroStrategy, who utilized the 5-year contracts in advance payment as advance payment, capitalized them in the first year to show his earnings.
Show the revenue.
Yeah, that was nice. That was nice. That was a little problem there. But I did have a good class action. That was one of the best I've ever seen.
I don't think that's accepted accounting rules now, is it?
No, it's a feature, not a bug. So, anyway, a lot of the players that I've heard talk recently are switched over to the fact that it's just an investment. It's a great investment. Why? Because it hit all-time highs and all that. And first, clarification, just so you know, I do hold a couple of Bitcoins. You know, it's a long story why. But I have Ethereum. I do have Ethereum. And by the way, I have 40 million Shiba Inu as well.
Great. What is that, like $9 or something?
Well, total, not per. If it gets to $1 somehow.
$9 in value.
It's like $1,600 in value. But if it ever, but it just tripled. That's why, too. It just tripled in value.
Yeah, because the price is, what is it, quad zeros?
Everybody's excited when it lost a zero recently.
Yes, yeah, well. Yeah, you lose a zero, man. That's like adding a zero to your net worth.
Right. So I was like, okay, that's good. Anyway, that's as I see it. Now, let's go through some of the things that have recently happened. Then we can kind of maybe go deeper into some of the things. So the big thing was that finally, oh my God, there's a real cash-based ETF that is legal. It will track. It will trade. And it's backed, and everybody's happy-pappy. And it first went down, then came back up. Let's talk about that.
The ETF?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay.
You want to go somewhere else first?
I mean, yeah, sure. The ETF is, you know, in comparison, I mean, you're talking about an absolute face melter. I don't think anybody really understood what would happen when this occurred. Because I think there are still a lot of skeptics, both on Wall Street and in traditional finance. I mean, and, you know, when you look at this, this thing is, I think, 505 million in net inflow just this last little bit. Now you got Jamie Dimon talking about inflows in the hundreds of billions in the next, you know, 5 years. I mean, these nine ETFs are doing something that's just never been done on Wall Street. There was a couple of, actually, one of your guys, Jim Bianco.
Mm-hmm.
He made a statement the other day. We played it on air, a clip of Jim Bianco, and he said that this was going to go down two ways. One way is this was going to just turn out to be a great ETF that might be one of the best of all time, or it was going to do something we've never seen before, and Wall Street could not get their head around.
Like what?
I don't know.
What does that mean?
Let's ask Jim.
I mean, what does it mean? Something great or something bad?
I think he was alluding to something great. You know, I can't imagine that he was alluding to something negative. However, my point, let's just so we can get a head around this. The ETFs are clearly accelerating this cycle because crypto works in these 4-year cycles. And it all, you know, kind of centers around this, you know, this major event called the halving. And the halving is really just a very simple computational change in the blockchain. You go from being able to run hash rates at X and you cut that in half. It doesn't destroy any of the previous supply. It simply just cuts out the amount of Bitcoin you can produce in half until the next halving. So there is a reduction in inflow of Bitcoin. And that in itself, I think, is going to continue to be a big problem because the amount of demand, if it continues, which I don't anticipate it's not going to continue, just is absolutely lopsided compared to the amount of availability. So you have a supply and demand problem. And anytime you have that, it's just simple economics.
So, okay? I mean, basically, because of the halving, what's happening is the miners have to pay a lot more in essentially cost energy. To the expense to actually mine.
Yep.
And then so and they the turn off their machines.
Like, yeah, the idea is that the value of it goes up. And in the history of Bitcoin, this has proved to be the case. The one major difference is there's a new party attendee, and that is those nine ETFs and BlackRock, and really the SEC, because the SEC obviously approving this. Now you have a regulated asset, and that in itself, I think, has normalized it. I don't know that I would say that it has become the 12th sector just yet. That would happen if, you know, more crypto projects or crypto products came to the table, whether it was Ethereum, Solana, Avalanche, some of those big blue chips that are out there right now that are L1s similar to Bitcoin.
But this makes my case for my third point. It's a speculative investment. No, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. It reaffirms it for me.
Okay, so you and I think are on the same page about Bitcoin, is that I believe Bitcoin is a speculative asset.
Yeah, that's all.
And I have a theory as to why you're hearing a shift in the narrative coming from guys like Saylor and others.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my theory.
Okay.
The theory is this. I don't think it's even a theory. I think it's real. It's a fact. We've proven it already. And this was when I turned my opinion toward Bitcoin differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that Bitcoin is a bad investment at all. And I'll give you some examples of this here in a second. But the problem with Bitcoin, if you're going to use it for what Satoshi Nakamoto was trying to do in the early days, mm-hmm. and this is where I believe he made a mistake, is calling it a cryptocurrency, which it is not. First of all, it does not have the bandwidth to be able to handle the transactions. Mm-hmm. The way that Bitcoin works, and there's a really cool little site out there. Just search South Park Bitcoin transactions and follow the links on that for the audience. And what it shows is the little South Park guys trying to get on the bus or the train, and it shows the amount of transactions. These are transactions on the blockchain. And then it has this transactions of the preferred people like MicroStrategies or BlackRock OTC type orders.
Right.
And the problem is that it's not fast enough to be able to handle transactions of everyday payments. So it will never become a payment system. It just will not. Just like gold is not.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Along with any silver, any of these speculative assets like that, they're not payment systems. However, and we'll get into this in a second, in 2017, all of that changed. That's when I looked at crypto and said, all right, there's a new dynamic here. It's called smart contracts. They haven't completely got it right yet, but if these guys are close, this is different because—
Well, that's different. That's not Bitcoin anymore, right?
No, we're talking about Ethereum and these other—
is also, just to be clear, once again, this nonsense that was being discussed early on about how the U.S. dollar will disappear and Bitcoin will take over, right? That was just a big discussion, wasn't it? That was a big.
I don't think so.
What do you mean? What are you talking about?
That was down in the bowels of crypto Twitter, bro.
I don't know about that. Everybody was all excited about the idea that we're going to, uncouple from this, and we need to stand strong, and Bitcoin needs to, it's going to change everybody's life, and that's why I'm buying it. And it's going to be, all countries are going to have to go. And I'm like, dudes, what are you talking about? The government will never allow Bitcoin to replace the dollar, or any government would. I mean, we did
Now we're getting. Yeah, now we're getting into a very different discussion because now you're talking about global economics here.
And it's not happening. Point is, reaffirming once again my theory and obviously yours. I'm reaffirming this, that Bitcoin is an asset, if you will, an investment, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. Have at it. Go at it. I like it. I love it. Let's talk about, though, now, as you mentioned, smart contract. Well, before we do that,
I want to stay on Bitcoin for a second because there are some great values of what Bitcoin represents, and the situation right now with Bitcoin is when you look at the rising inflationary situation of the U.S. dollar, you look at the global economic position of what BRICS is doing, the possible CBDC creation, well, not possible, already done in Russia and in China with the digital yuan. The potential of alternative currencies being transacted is a real, it's a real issue now. And when I say alternative to the dollar. So yes. the likelihood.
But let's just state something, but still the currency of the country. Just.
Yeah. In the currencies. Yeah. They're settling in the currencies of the company, but that's a huge deal because that's pulling a lot of pull from the U.S. dollar. You know this, Andrew. Uh-huh. I mean, the strength of the U.S. dollar is going to wane. And at some point, there will be some sort of digital currency, whether that is a CBDC or it is a gold-backed Bitcoin or something else that comes up yet. Now, I believe that there will be, I'm going to say this on your podcast.
Uh-oh.
I don't say this too often.
Uh-oh.
I believe there will be another Bitcoin. They are going to have to fork Bitcoin. Now, this is like blasphemy in the Bitcoin community. If I said this on my show, first of all, people would lose it. They don't understand the limitations of what Bitcoin. If we want to be able to use this technology in a different way for payments, or other than maybe cross-border payments and moving assets, large amount of assets, one or two times, three or four times a year, not weekly or monthly or any of that kind of stuff. But I think they'll have to fork it. And there's a lot of the original developers that now are believing that same thing. And there's a big, big, struggle going on between the six houses of the, almost like Game of Thrones, activity that's happening in the developer community. The other thing that you have to worry about is the centralization of this asset, which is a situation that I'm starting to get very intrigued with because of the miner problem that could happen. The miners themselves could also collude to try to fork Bitcoin themselves. BlackRock could try to say, let's do an alternative to this with a fork. This is open technology, okay?
So and then everything just funnels in and we lose on what. Now, Is Bitcoin,
it's been tried before.
Well, like
it has
Bitcoin
been tried
Cash. Isn't that Bitcoin Cash?
Yes, Bitcoin Cash was a fork.
Right.
It's been tried before. And if you get into, you know, some of the true science behind what Nakamoto was trying to do, we're getting into the weeds a little bit. But the point is, as I'm saying, it's a good investable asset right now until it's not, just like any stock.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It was a time when Blockbuster was a great asset. All of these things go with the way of tech.
Right.
And tech does one thing that people discount over and over. It changes.
Mm-hmm.
It constantly changes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been in this since, you know, college. I there's nothing that has broken that cycle.
Yeah.
So I don't hold a lot of Bitcoin for that very reason. It's not that I don't like it. I still base all my investment strategies around Bitcoin, because if Bitcoin's up, the likelihood is other L1s are up, and also the L2s, and then the whole ecosystem, because it's like NVIDIA right now. If NVIDIA is up, the rest of the, you know, top five and all the other AI, you know, stocks are up.
It's basically basket trading.
Exactly. So that's what you're facing. But once that is solved, I think it's going to get solved. And there's a lot of people that don't think it's going to get solved because people don't want to change Bitcoin. And I think that it needs an upgrade.
Yeah.
Simple as that. You know, Ethereum just went through an upgrade this week, which was designed to reduce the fees in which these transactions can move on what they call L2s, layer twos. So we're starting to hit a lot of the L2s right now. Optimism, Arbitrum, all the L2s are starting to get it. What this will do is reduce transaction fees down to fractions. So now you can deal with micro transactions, payments. You can buy a cup of coffee. You can use transactions inside a game or a token. You can be able to use this as a real world asset technology through smart contracts. That is a game changer when you look at blockchain as a use case for the future. And Jamie Dimon is already doing this with Onyx and what they're doing with Evergreen and everything. The chain that they're doing that on is Avalanche. So that is the scenario that is happening. And that's where I think that's why our channel talks about this stuff much more pragmatic. Sure, we cover Bitcoin because it is the NVIDIA of crypto.
Mm-hmm.
Just is. It doesn't make sense.
It's no longer the Apple of crypto.
It's NVIDIA. NVIDIA is that. It's very early.
Yeah, I got it.
And it's a lot of blue sky. You don't know what's going to happen. AI might be a thing. It might not be a thing. We don't know, right?
Right.
We don't know. I mean, a lot of people think that NVIDIA has a run rate, you know, that is only maybe another 3 or 4 quarters. We could get into a whole
cycle. Just if you do a comparison of Dell back in the day,
exactly.
and we said, oh, everybody's buying Dells, the PC, look at that.
Bingo.
And then everybody's like, wait a second. If we keep this run rate up,
well,
that means I'm going to have
three about a different
PCs
thing.
No, actually, I
disagree.
Why?
Because Dell was retail. NVIDIA, it'd be more like buying Oracle or buying Cisco, okay? Cisco had its run, but once the internet was created, once all of the infrastructure was created, I mean, you only needed to do updates at that
time. That's what I'm talking about. The same thing with Dell with the PCs on the desktops. Everybody thought it was going to be the same run rate. You'd have to have 3 or 4 PCs on your desktop in the next 2 years to keep the run rate going.
Yeah.
Which was unnecessary.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that argue this because I think eventually this will be a software problem that gets solved in the compute, or it will be a decentralized compute solution. And that's where you get into blockchain again for decentralized compute. That is another option, which is there's a couple of projects out there. One is called Render. It rides on a blockchain called Solana. That is a decentralized rendering technology that's designed to render graphics at, you know, what used to be very expensive processing fees to now pennies on the dollar.
Wow. That's important.
That's an efficient model, and it's decentralized. Okay. So you don't get leveraged in on all these high cost servers, whether you're AWS or you're, you know, Azure or any of those others that are out there. Then you have the next level, which is this thing called DPIN, which is decentralized physical infrastructure networks, DPIN. These are very intriguing because now you're talking about mapping systems like Google Maps, Uber Eats, logistics, anything you can imagine that needs a physical infrastructure network to operate. IoT was what was and kind of is still built for most of the municipalities around the world to be able to get data, everything from weather to, you know, water safety, you name the things. IoT is the infrastructure that
hold,
that
hold,
is
hold, using. Hold. IoT is Internet of Things. I think that was Cisco who coined that, wasn't it?
Many companies. Yeah, Cisco, I think, might have coined it. Mm. But IoT, there's a lot of different infrastructure or hardware solutions out there for IoT. But
IoT, by the way, also is like when I think of IoT, I don't know why I think of this. I don't even know if they still have them. The Amazon buttons.
Yeah.
That was kind of like an IoT, like.
Yeah, but that rides on Wi-Fi.
I get that, but it was kind of like that's like all these things that are all connected. That says, yes. You know, and that was
mesh networks.
I'm going to take this little button that buys Tide and stick it on the side of my washing machine. And I look, I'm out, I push the button and I get another one delivered 2 days from now. Mm-hmm. That was,
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, we're getting into a lot of the weeds, but my point is with Bitcoin is right now it's being introduced to the market for the first time. I think the shine is still on the coin and it's going to stay on the coin as long as BlackRock says it will stay on the coin.
Yes.
And we know how that works.
Yeah. I want to share with you something. Can I share something with you? When I was on your show, you asked me about Coinbase. And I'm not exactly sure my answer, but I think I recollect my answer as being the question was what if there's an ETF? What happens to Coinbase? And I said, you know what? I'm not quite sure. I think it could be problematic for Coinbase because if in fact there's an ETF, why would people want to trade Bitcoin on Coinbase? They could just do it very easily on the ETF side. So there's two things I may have missed with that. Number one was who they choose to custody the Bitcoin to begin with, number one. And the second thing was that Coinbase, while trading may be down significantly to a degree on a retail side, right?
No, it's not.
Well, what I'm saying is it could have been is what I'm saying. The other thing is that they also hold Bitcoin, right? They are.
Well, they settle the Bitcoin daily for BlackRock and most of the other funds.
Right. So my point is I kind of missed that too as a point of reference that I kind of like didn't put that into my calculus at the time.
Well, let's say here, Coinbase is up 547% since the ETF was approved.
That's what I'm saying. I missed that point. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. I missed those 2 points. So,
So back to Bitcoin. Bitcoin, good. You know, it's a great technology, but at some point it will be either advanced, which is, as I said, kind of a blasphemy statement. And at some point, it may even become, you know, a store of value, much like gold. Okay, and I think a lot of people still look at Bitcoin as digital gold. That's the way I see it. You know, I see it more volatile than gold because of the kind of players that are in there. But that eventually will start to curtail over time, especially as more sophisticated investors come in because they just won't sell. You know, the diamond hands term that's used in crypto a lot are by a lot of people out there. You have to remember, crypto was built off of people who did not have money, all right? These are people that became wealthy for the first time, first-generation wealth. They are experiencing wealth for the first time, most of which have lost their wealth back to the people who have held wealth for a long time. And now you're seeing for the first time, Bill Ackman put out a tweet this week that I thought was interesting. He's on a road tour. And he said something that was interesting in this tweet, that the pushback from a lot of these family offices and these high money managers like yourself, et cetera, had started to wane. In other words, all the things that they used to say were bad about Bitcoin, they're not saying now. And these people, as you know, are people who invest in something and stay in it. You know, if they believe the narrative, if they like the concept of what they're doing, they're going to ride it out for the most part. Mm-hmm. Now, sure, there are people out there doing, you know, swing trades and things of that nature, but it's a different kind of investor. And I think that's going to continue to push the Bitcoin narrative up. Because of that, it's going to push the rest of the market up, just like NVIDIA pushes up.
Many of these people couldn't use any kind of cryptocurrency at all because it wasn't approved. And once you get SEC approval,
of course
they can change their commentary. You know, maybe before they can't do it. It's not good because this and that is not regulated, et cetera. And now they're like, well, you know, it's available. So, okay, let's you know, do something.
You know, we were one of the company, we were one of the channels that went out on the limb on what our theory was going to be after post ETF. And my point had always been, listen, when Wall Street comes to the game, you may not like what comes out on the other side, but it is going to drive the market up.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that I think the shift of control, listen, BlackRock is going head to head right now for the most Bitcoin out there against Michael Saylor and MicroStrategies.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing that in 8 weeks. It's taken Michael Saylor 2.5 years. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is a matter of time before BlackRock, Fidelity, ARK, and a handful of others, VanEck, pretty much will control the market on this. It's going to be a different game in about 18 months for Bitcoin.
Cool. You want to just get a little bit into, we're kind of running a little bit late here. We talked about Ethereum, I guess. We talked about that. Anything else exciting happening? Web3, anything happening with some of the abilities to do in payment, build on, especially with these new called goggles. I don't know what you call them. The face.
Yeah, I think. AR, VR. That's a big opportunity for Web3, which are mostly everything from layer twos to some of these special projects that drive within it. You look at Solana, Avalanche, and Ethereum. Those are the kind of the three. Now there's also projects out there like Flow. That's one that's tied in with Disney. That one is more around brand IP and collectibles.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that's going to happen in the gaming experiences. And you've got to remember the gaming market is one of the largest, if not the largest consumer market out there on the planet, 3 billion gamers. If NFTs and or blockchain make their way into gaming, which they are starting to do really for the first time, GDC is going on right now, which is the gamer developers conference, that is just nothing but, people that create games and blockchain Web3 is getting its first real test, on maybe migrating a lot of the Web2 developers over into that space. That market is going to explode because of the amount of game companies that will come out of it. And then the amount of in-game economies that will be built from this, including things like Roblox. You know, Roblox eventually will start having value NFTs in their game that owners, because my kids play it right now, they're collecting, they always want Robux to buy this or buy that. It's a digital asset, mm-hmm. But they can't trade it. They can't own it, but eventually that's going to happen. Microsoft is the other one, I think, that will be an early player.
Can Meta I ask you something about Solana? Can we just go back to Solana?
Yeah, sure.
Am I wrong about Solana that it's not doing so well?
You are.
Because I'm looking at Solana USD right now.
You are very wrong.
I know. What am I looking at? Why am I? I'm on. $18. Is that not right?
No, no. Solana is breaking through all time. Well, not all time highs, but local highs. Yeah, it's at $174. It's up 790% since November of last year.
Solon.
Yeah, SOL. USD.
Oh, a Coinbase. Maybe it's 168 right now. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, Solana is on fire. Yeah, that token.
That was, that was the FTX one.
Yeah, it was. And that's another problem that I think a lot of people misconstrue about Solana because, they were looking at all the VCs that were involved in it. And everybody was like, hey, the VCs are just going to dump on you. And for the most part, they did all the way down to $8, which is when it hit, what was it, last December and January?
Mm-hmm.
It hit $8 in 23. And it has done nothing but go up since then. And part of that was the FTX debacle because you can't really control who your investors are, but that's part of what was that. But I think Solana is one of the rebirth stories of blockchain. And they're a project that goes head to head with Ethereum. And the idea, fast transactions, low settlement fees, simple as that. Solana and Avalanche are in that game. You look at Solana being used primarily now for a lot of the test with Visa, which is looking at utilizing blockchain for settlement on merchant transactions.
Yeah.
If that even gets close to reality, I don't even know what these projects would look like because the amount of fees that they would generate, which would mean profitability, and then the yields that come into this. This is where you get into DeFi. That, you know, right now, if you look at Ethereum, there's so much play on the backside of Ethereum for yields on a lot of these networks where they just lock the token up and they yield anywhere between 7 to 20% just for locking a token up for, you know, it's kind of like a CD in essence, but you're not locking it up for years. You're locking
without
it up
all the leverage though, like we had from some of the players that almost destroyed the industry.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's a, I kind of think this time around, we finally are getting respectable, mainly that you have to, because of the pressure that's coming in from the SEC, the pressure that's coming in from the regulatory bodies on Capitol Hill.
Right.
And now I think it's going to be pressures from nation states that are going to start playing in this stuff. And there is no more Wall Street bets bullshit going to be happening in crypto. This thing is getting way too serious now.
We shall see. There's always some kind of bullshit going on somewhere, though, isn't there?
No kidding. No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Paul Barron from the Paul Barron Network. Definitely check that out. We'll have all the information on how to get in touch with Paul and check out all of his various streaming deals on DeFi and crypto and some of the food stuff from the past. All the different things will be on the show notes for episode number 860 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. As always, thanks for joining me. I look forward to getting together. We'll have some lunch and drink soon.
We got to do it.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.
That's going to end this episode. It's going to wrap it up. It's going to take it right to the end. Boy, that was a lot of information, a lot of quick, very interesting, very intense. So if you want more and you want to learn more, go over to the Paul Barron Network. He'll give you a blast of information on a regular basis about everything about crypto. But I think we did cover a good amount of area. A lot of questions that you probably had were hopefully answered, probably added a few that you may have as well moving forward. But we do our best to try to not confuse, but to educate. Sometimes education is confusing. Thank you for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again next week with another great guest coming on board. Thanks again. Discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.